Caitlin Rivers. I'm a graduate student with the Network Dynamics and Simulation Science Laboratory at the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute, which is located at Virginia Tech. And today I'm going to be speaking about using simulations to help us plan for major disasters. And I have nothing to disclose. So what I'm going to be describing today is a simulation of National Planning Scenario 1. And the National Planning Scenarios are a set of 15 scenarios that range from terrorist situations, hypothetical terrorist events, to natural disasters. And they are intended to be planning tools for federal, state, and local emergency planning officials. And National Planning Scenario 1 is one of those 15, and it is a unannounced 10 kiloton detonation of an improvised nuclear device in downtown Washington, D.C. on a weekday morning. So that's the topic of the simulation. The motivation for using simulations as a planning tool is that real-life disasters are very difficult to study because they're unpredictable, they're chaotic, and they're dangerous. It's difficult to plan to deploy researchers to disasters because obviously you don't know when they're going to happen. And it's difficult to do it retrospectively because it's hard to find survivors, it's hard to have those conversations, and any data you gather is going to have a strong survivor bias. That being said, we know that proper preparation for these kinds of disasters saves lives, so there's a need for data-driven emergency interventions. And that's where simulations can really help. And in particular, agent-based simulations, which is what was used in this simulation, are useful because they allow the capture of how individual behaviors can sum to more than the individual parts. So patterns emerge from the systems, from individual people acting as individual agents, but they create patterns, and that can create a complex system. So I'm going to back up a little bit and talk about how we create highly detailed models. This is something that our lab uses for a lot of studies, so it's sort of an existing platform that we have. There's basically three components to a recipe of a highly detailed agent-based model. There's locations, peoples, and activities. And in our model, each person in the population in question, so in this case, Washington, D.C. and surrounding areas, is represented by demographic information like their sex, their household income, their daily activities, which is important, like they go to work, they drop their kid off at daycare, and so on. And that information is also geographically located. So we know approximately where they go to work, where they live, and so on, and that information is mapped to their demographics. So that information exists for each synthetic individual in our population, and those are combined to create an entire population. So the graphic there on the side represents a household of four people, and for example, the green person is maybe one of the parents, maybe they carpool to work, then they leave and go to lunch, go back to work, carpool home, and so on, whereas the yellow person is maybe a child who rides in the car to daycare, rides home, and then returns home to their three family members. And so those are activities for two synthetic individuals. And note, too, that when, for example, the green person goes to work, they are co-located with all other people who work in that location. So there's also the movements between people, between locations, which will come to be of interest later. That's sort of our basic recipe. But for this study, we had a couple extra details beyond our usual scope. We included a number of modules, including infrastructure, transportation, communication, power of Washington, D.C., as well as the behavior and health of synthetic individuals in the population. I'm going to give a brief overview of a few of those models, and then I'm going to focus on behavior, which is more the topic of this talk. For those modules I just described, the additional ones, the data comes from a variety of sources, including the National Planning Scenario studies, metro bus routes, hospital registries, and so on. So we have a lot of data aggregated from a lot of different sources that go into making this scenario as realistic as possible. The population that we use to create our D.C. population is not just the people who, according to census, live in the D.C. area. We also included tourists, business travelers, college students, and emergency responders. Because a disaster like this is going to heavily impact people who are not permanent residents. For example, if you were on vacation or something, like your behavior might be different than those who have a home in the area to return to. So it's not just the half a million people who live in Washington, D.C., but it's also the transient population. One of our modules, as I mentioned, is the physical infrastructure, and in something like a radiological detonation, the infrastructure is going to be important because the detonation is going to destroy some of it. So clockwise from top there is the built infrastructure, and the red area indicates the area that has received damage from the detonation. The bottom picture there is the position of people, and you'll notice that it's in kind of a funny cone shape, and that's because we chose to model the fallout area. So places north and west that would likely not receive damage from the detonation nor radioactive fallout to the same extent were not modeled in such detail. And the bottom left there is power outages, and obviously the area immediately surrounding the detonation receives significant damage to the power infrastructure. And at time point zero, which is when the detonation happened, everyone in the DC population is in our synthetic population where they would be at that time, so 11 a.m. on a weekday morning. So people are at work, kids are at daycare, kids are at school, and so on. And in addition, people who would be in transit at that time are also located on transit routes. And for each synthetic individual in the population, a power outage, like whether or not they have access to electricity, damage and rubble around them, and the radiation dose rate are assigned to each person in the population. Another one of our modules is the transportation network, and this one was a little more detailed than we normally require. So not only do we have the Washington, D.C. road network, but we also include bus and metro routes and walking paths, because following a major disaster, it's difficult sometimes to evacuate by car, so people are going to be on foot, they're going to be on the bus, and so on. So that level of detail is included in this simulation. And now on to the behavior module, which is really the focus. The data, well, first let me describe that the behavior module describes human behavior in disasters. So we're using this to predict or to describe what people do in the event of one of these disasters. And this is behaviors are chosen for each individual in the synthetic population, which I'll discuss a little bit more in detail, but just so you understand where we're going with this. The data used to describe human behavior following disasters were drawn from sociological studies of human behavior following disasters. And these really fall into three major epochs. The first was the Cold War, which was characterized by nuclear threats, and the research focus was really on threats to human health. Post 9/11, there was a lot of interest in terrorist events and building evacuations in particular. There's quite a few studies on how people evacuated the World Trade Centers. And then finally, Katrina, and the research focus for Katrina-based events were really on long-term disasters and area evacuations, and in particular, how major disasters affect vulnerable populations. And so all of those three major areas of research sort of combine in this study of National Planning Scenario 1 to describe how people might react following a disaster. I wanted to give you a little preview here of how we chose human behaviors. Before we describe it in detail, I thought it might be helpful if you were able to see where we're going with this. This is a decision tree, and for each agent in the population, a behavior was chosen from this decision tree. So I'll walk you through it here. Each branch of the tree is a behavior option, which is contingent on individual circumstances. And the tree splits on parameters like time, agent health, family status, and family health. So for example, I'm going to go back one here. In the first hour following the disaster, the important decision point was the health of the agent. So if they retained enough mobility capacity to, for example, evacuate, then that remained an option, whereas if they were immobile, they would no longer have the option to evacuate. That's just one example of many here. And the probability of the simulation choosing certain branches of the decision tree changes over time. So the actions like calling 911 become less likely after the event. And you'll notice that the terminal node or the end of the tree is a goal. So something like reunite with family or seek health care or so on. And to achieve those goals, agents undertake actions like moving to a specified location, making a call, or texting in order to accomplish those options. And you'll notice those last two, making a call and texting, are going to have an influence on the communication networks. I'm not sure if anyone noticed over Sandy, FEMA and emergency planning operations were urging people to either text or send internet messages to their friends and family because communication networks can become overburdened during a disaster. Everyone's trying to use them, in addition to the reduced capacity of having suffered a major insult. So here's that decision tree again. Another example might be an hour or more after the event, reuniting family becomes a more important option. And once again, that data comes from sociological literature on people's behavior following disasters. So people tend to like to reunite with their families. They're not likely to evacuate on their own. They want to find their kids or their spouses or so on. And so once again, one of these behaviors was chosen for a certain time period for each individual in the population. So for example, an agent might reconstitute family, and when that happens, then a new option would be chosen. So maybe then the family would evacuate as a whole. One thing I really want to stress here is that the modules that I have been describing are interactive. They're an iterative process. So I mentioned that someone's health might influence their behavior, so their capacity to evacuate. And that in turn is going to impact the transportation networks, because if someone tries to evacuate, then that's one more person on the roads. And maybe then they choose to evacuate, but they're exposed to radiation, and so that in turn deteriorates their health. So all of these behaviors and all of these modules interact to form a complex system. And that's something that we've been able to capture in the simulation. Another thing I want to emphasize is that a lot of emergency planning sort of exercises tend to emphasize the physical infrastructure, so the buildings that are destroyed and the roadways and so on. But it's really, there's more pieces to the puzzle. It's the interactions that tie them together. So the infrastructure and behavior, demand on the system, these are all things that interact to change the way that the disaster unfolds. And survivors are not just sort of acting in a bubble. They are really interacting with each other and with the local context. And that's why it's important to use an agent-based simulation rather than perhaps a more high-level approach. So I want to give you a few snapshots of the sorts of things that fell out of this simulation. Results are still preliminary at this point, but this is sort of the one thing we're seeing, is that emergency broadcasts are very important to the way that the disaster unfolds. In a case where emergency broadcasts are not restored, people tend to seek shelter less, perhaps because they don't understand what's going on. You can't tell when a radioactive device has been detonated as opposed to a regular one necessarily. In contrast, during a partial restoration of emergency broadcasts, we see a lot more people seeking shelter. And this is just one example of the way that one small change in the way that a disaster unfolds can really impact the long-term outcomes. Another example, also pertaining to emergency broadcasts, is the transportation loads. In blue, you can see the no restoration case, and in purple, you can see the partial restoration case. So what we're perhaps seeing here is a change in evacuation timing or patterns, and that's once again due to the restoration of emergency broadcasts. This was a movie. I'm not sure it's going to work. So I'll just briefly describe that this has to do with people who have sought health care, and you can see the distribution of population geographically according to that behavior. Slide right over that one. The thing I want to emphasize on this slide is that family status, once again, is a major driver of behavior. So if people are able to contact their family and establish their family safety, then they're more likely to, for example, take protective action, like seeking shelter, rather than undertaking what could be perhaps some more dangerous behavior, like going into the disaster zone to look for family. So in conclusion, we found that modeling these socially coupled systems not only changes the answers, but the questions we ask. And things that you might not expect to be very influential for the outcomes of disasters, we can show that they are super important. And that's why simulation can enable communities to optimize mitigation and relief efforts. And because current emergency plans do not consider behavior, this leads to unrealistic assessments of how events unfold. And that's why simulation can be a useful platform for understanding disasters as a complex system. And once again, this is really useful for assisting emergency planners with designing and implementing effective interventions to optimize rescue efforts, healthcare delivery, traffic control, and infrastructure protection. And this was a very large study that a lot of people worked on, so I'd like to recognize the many, many people who contributed to this effort.